questions before I start? Not many people today, which I hope is not a sign that I made the homework too long and everyone is hiding, finishing. Today I just want to finish up discussion of the Fisher matrix and then talk about some GR topics. I want to start by, you'll see what this has to do with the Fisher matrix in a minute, but I want to start by talking about a GR thing, which is that suppose you have two particles moving in a space-time, and their world lines intersect at some point x. And at the point where they intersect, the forward momentum of particle 1 is p mu, and the forward momentum of particle 2 is q mu. And there's some metric at this point, g mu nu. Then you can ask the question, what is the energy E12 of particle 1 as observed in the rest frame of particle 2? So particle 2 is an observer carrying a detector. What energy would they measure? There's a particular type of argument in GR where you work out the, to answer a question like this, you work out the answer in a coordinate system that is convenient, and then figure out how to write it in a coordinate system invariant way so that you get the answer in an arbitrary coordinate system. And I don't know whether this type of argument has a name, so I just wanted to illustrate it by example. The way it could work here is that if you use, if we define primed coordinates, to be the normal coordinates in particle 2's frame, normal coordinates mean that the metric just takes this simple form. You can always choose normal coordinates so that that is true at one point. You could not choose normal coordinates so that the metric had this form in a whole neighborhood of points around this point where the world lines intersect. That would imply that all the derivatives of the components of G were zero, which would imply that the Riemann curvature tensor is zero. And that is something that you cannot make zero or non-zero through a choice of coordinate system. If this were a curved spacetime, then the Riemann curvature tensor, because it transforms as a tensor, would have to be non-zero in every coordinate system. But if I'm just talking, everything in this problem will just be at this point. And so I can always choose normal coordinates that ride along with particle 2 to make the metric look like this at one point. Normal coordinates also mean that the forward momentum of particle 2 just looks like this. And in this coordinate system, the quantity E12 that I'm trying to calculate would look like this, where there's some momentum here that I don't care about. I forgot to put primes on this. So there are, in this coordinate system, there are various ways to write E12. Like you could write it as simply p prime 0. But if you stare at these expressions and look for a way of writing it which transforms as a scalar, then one way of doing that is to write it as p prime. Oh, sorry, I forgot to say this is, I said q was the forward momentum, so I'm going to make this the mass of the rest mass of particle 2. So I could write E12 as p prime 0 over the rest mass of particle 2. Or another way of writing it would be minus d mu nu prime p prime mu q prime mu over m2 with the minus sign for my sign convention for the metric. And this way of writing it is a scalar under coordinate transformations. And so it would follow that in the original coordinate system, the same expression applied. And this is a nice way of answering this question, a coordinate system independent way of answering the question. So I often find this kind of argument useful in GR, where you think in a coordinate system that's convenient, where you can write everything down explicitly, and then just figure out how to arrange the result so that it transforms as a scalar under coordinate transformations. Does anyone know if this type of argument, this type of reasoning, has a name? I feel like there should be a name for it, but I don't think there is one. Now I want to go back to talk about the Fisher matrix. So the Fisher matrix is defined abstractly in a statistical situation where you have some model space of parameters and that determines some data according to some conditional probability distribution. And we had this general definition of the Fisher matrix. This definition makes sense given a preferred model in the space, a fiducial model, but we don't need a preferred realization of the data. That the definition averages over realizations of the data, so that it's a tool for forecasting, not data analysis. And this matrix is supposed to be a forecast for if a particular model was the truth, and you did the experiment, for a typical realization of the experiment. The Fisher matrix is supposed to forecast the inverse covariance matrix of the parameter constraints that you would get when you did the experiment. Now here's an interesting, last time I started talking about just general properties of the Fisher matrix as defined in this general way. And here's an interesting property that suppose I have a sub-model of the original model. So I have my model in some number n of parameters, and I'm interested in a submodel with fewer parameters. So formally that means that the thetas now are a function of the theta primes. Theta is a function of the theta primes. Or I could draw the picture this way, where I have some lower dimensional space of theta primes that's embedded in the larger model space. Then a general property of the Fisher matrix is that it has a transformation law under embeddings of this type. That if I were to compute the primed Fisher matrix here, that it's related to the original Fisher matrix by applying some Jacobian factors. By the way, this is true. I described it as a submodel, but it would also be true if the number of variables, the number of theta primes, was the same as the number of thetas, in which case I would be talking about a reparameterization of the model. Now, this is the same transformation law as a metric with two lower indices, as a metric in GR. That's true if the theta primes are a reparameterization. This is the usual formula for change of variables, how the metric transforms under a coordinate transformation in GR. And it's also true if you have a
subspace of a larger space with a metric, there's an induced metric or a pullback metric that's given by the same formula. The Jacobian matrices are just rectangular instead of square matrices.
That would be true if the indices were upper and not lower.
Oh, you're absolutely right. Thanks. Thanks. So it's useful to think of the Fisher matrix as a metric on the parameter space. Many properties of GR just follow from the transformation law of the metric, or really just far-reaching consequences. Almost all the math of GR is really just a far-reaching consequence of this transformation law for the metric, and so we can carry over a lot of GR machinery. So just like GR, this is some symmetric matrix that can depend on the thetas. There's an intuitive way to think about this Fisher matrix distance, which is that it's defining a notion of distance between points, between two models, that corresponds to their observational distinguishability. In this abstract situation where I have some model space, and the only extra structure that's lying around is a probability distribution that tells me how some data would be randomly generated from the model, that's really the only way that you could think of to define how different two models are, is by their distinguishability when you do the experiment. So roughly speaking, two models whose distance, Fisher matrix distance, is one, are two models that would be forecasted to be distinguishable at one sigma when the experiment is done. A lot of properties of the Fisher matrix that are might have, you know, extended proofs in a statistics book can be derived by thinking about the Fisher matrix this way and applying this type of GR reasoning. So here's an example that you would use all the time if you want to be a professional Fisher matrixologist. So we interpreted the Fisher matrix as being the inverse of the covariance matrix. And in particular, that means that if I'm interested in forecasting the one sigma statistical error on one of the parameters theta A, then I could get that by inverting the Fisher matrix and then taking the diagonal element AAA. That's the variance of theta A. Now that I'm using the GR picture, I'm being careful to write indices in the right place. In previous lectures, so I'm writing the Fisher matrix with two lower indices and the inverse Fisher matrix with two upper indices, so that the transformation laws are implicit. I wasn't so careful about doing that in previous lectures, so the indices were all over the place. So now you might ask the question, so this is what I would do if I were doing a Fisher matrix forecast, forecasting some experiment, and I was interested in forecasting the error on a parameter, which was one of the basis parameters in the coordinate system where I computed the Fisher matrix. But what would I do if I had some other parameter pi, which is just a function defined on this model space, and I want to compute its statistical error? Well, one answer could be you recompute the Fisher matrix in a coordinate system where pi is one of the basis parameters, say theta 1. But if you wanted to do it without recomputing the Fisher matrix, you could reason as follows. That in a, let's say, where pi is just some function of the thetas. There's an example on the problem set where you're computing a Fisher matrix in some space of cosmological parameters, and the parameter omega lambda is a parameter which just doesn't happen to be one of the basis parameters. Um, So following the GR reasoning, if I work in primed coordinates, where pi is, say, the first coordinate in the coordinate system, then it would follow that the inverse Fisher matrix, the inverse Fisher matrix in that primed coordinate system, its diagonal element would be the error that I'm looking for. So let me write it this way. The rest of the elements unspecified. And the gradient of pi, which transforms as a tensor with one lowered index, would start out 1. Look like this. Prime. And so I haven't said, I didn't fully define the coordinate system. There are some other parameters, but they can be chosen arbitrarily. So a non-covariant formula for the statistical error on prime, on pi, would be, sorry, this should have a square root. In the prime coordinate system, I could write the statistical error that I'm looking for as like this. That would be a non-covariant formula. Or I could write it like this. And this is a coordinate system invariant. These vectors and tensors have the correct transformation law, so that when I contract them this way, I get something independent of the coordinate system. So I can write the answer this way, back in the original base. Oops. So this is a useful formula that's in the statistics textbooks. Another way of thinking about it is that if I have some function pi, and I want to know what its variance is over this ellipse, then that's just the same thing as the length of the gradient of pi. Where the length is defined with respect to the Fisher matrix distance. One more example, which is also part of the problem set. Suppose I have some Fisher matrix forecasted the Fisher matrix for some experiment. And now I want to modify the forecast by adding an external measurement. Of some parameter pi. Which need not be a basis parameter. That is one of the functions defining the coordinate system. With some variance, sigma squared. So that could be a prior. You might be interested in doing a forecast with some prior on a parameter that's restricting it to a physically plausible range of values. Or you might just want to, maybe you want to include another experiment in the forecast. Last time we said that another property of the Fisher matrix was that it was additive as you added independent data sets. So if you had another measurement that you were adding, which was simple enough that it could be described this way, then you would also be interested in knowing the answer to this question. I won't work out the details, but by a similar argument, transforming to the coordinate system where pi is one of the basis parameters, and then transforming back, you can show that the answer looks like this. Notice that this has indices in all the right places to be tensorial. If this equation is true, this is relating the new and the old Fisher matrices. In other words, if this equation is true in one coordinate system, then it's true in every coordinate system. One more example just for fun. A situation that arises, for example, in LIGO is you might be interested in a merger where the theta space of model parameters is some long list of parameters describing the black hole, like the chirp mass, the mass ratio, the angular momentum, and so on. And for each point in the space, you can generate a waveform to add to your online search. And you want to tile the space efficiently with waveforms. If LIGO searches over some finite list of waveforms that are pre-computed. And if I tile the space too densely, then I'm wasting computation time by searching. My search is redundant in that it searches waveforms that are highly correlated with each other or not very distinguishable. And if I don't tile it densely enough, then my search might miss some events. If the true parameters are here, there might not be a nearby point that's highly correlated with the true parameters. The way that you choose these points is you just compute a Fisher matrix in the space. There's some PDF, which is LIGO specific, that tells you how, for a particular set of parameters, what the waveform looks like. And then you want to tile the, just go through the space and try to choose points whose, the rule for choosing the points is that the Fisher distance between the points should be one or some threshold, which is a tunable parameter that trades computation time for optimality of the search. If you wanted to know, for example, what is the total number of waveforms that you need to search over, if you wanted to figure out how many computers you needed to buy, then your GR intuition would suggest that the answer is the Fisher volume of the search space. That is, you integrate, instead of square root minus g, you integrate square root minus f, square root f, where f is the determinant of the Fisher matrix. And that's the right answer. So my real reason for bringing all of this up, I think, is that the word statistics is mentioned, I think there's a certain expectation of boringness. Like when I said a couple of days ago that we were going to be talking about statistics, probably no one moved to the edge of their seat in anticipation. But it is actually interesting when you get into it. There's some geometric picture that is nice. And you get to import some interesting math, like differential geometry. One of the things that I think is fun about statistics or about cosmology is getting able to work with the interesting parts of a few different fields, physics, statistics, and software engineering. So I wanted to just have a few lectures in the class to convey the the sense of it. I didn't try to exhaustively list every property of the Fisher matrix, for example. I listed a few, but my list is not complete. I just wanted to sort of give a sense for what it was about. And there's some homework problems where you'll get to compute some of these matrices, Fisher matrices. But of course, there's lots more statistics we could do, but I'm actually just going to leave it at that. In particular, we didn't really talk about, we got into the machinery for forecasting, but not really the machinery for data analysis in complex situations. I decided not to cover that. I'm going to switch topics and go back to physics and talk about GR for a while. So, in the next few lectures, I'm going to talk about some GR tools, which are not necessarily in a first GR class. I'm going to talk about the Lie derivative and gauge transformations. About extrinsic curvature. And the ADM formulation of GR. I'm going to make the discussion as general as possible, but an example that I'm going to use as a motivating example, suppose we're interested in doing first order perturbation theory. In single field inflation. So occasionally illustrate things in this example. The action in this theory is, so this is a theory where the degrees of freedom are the metric tensor and a scalar inflaton. This is the action. And we're going to be interested in a situation where the metric is a first order perturbation of some background solution. Where the background metric is FRW. And the background inflaton solution is slowly varying. In this perturbation theory situation, the background or zeroth order piece, the all degrees of freedom in the metric and the inflaton are functions only of time, but the perturbation can be functions of space and time. I wrote it wrong here, but it should have been delta phi function of x and t. So I want to start by talking about today about this topic, the Lie derivative and gauge transformations. So if we're thinking about perturbation theory in single field inflation, then one thing that can happen is that suppose that you had no perturbations, delta G and delta phi were zero. So the surfaces of constant phi would be horizontal. generally speaking, in GR, one has the freedom to choose a new coordinate system without affecting any of the physics. So you might take this unperturbed situation and apply a first-order coordinate transformation in which the new time coordinate is a function, t prime, is a function of space and time, thus making the surfaces of constant phi look non-horizontal. So delta phi, the perturbation delta phi would be 0 here and non-zero here. In other words, the question of whether these perturbations are 0 or non-zero is a coordinate system dependent question. We say that a mode like this, a set of perturbations delta g, mu nu, delta phi, which is obtained by applying a first-order coordinate transformation to the zeroth order background, is a gauge mode. Such a mode, if I have a set of perturbations which is a gauge mode, that means it's some kind of a fake perturbation. In a different coordinate system, the metric would be unperturbed. And two sets of perturbations that differ by a gauge mode should be understood as being physically equivalent. They were just the same perturbation written down in different coordinate systems. So the gauge symmetry of GR that lets me apply an arbitrary gauge mode to a given set of perturbations is sort of a redundancy of description, where there are more, we have more variables than we need to describe the physically equivalent configurations. There are 11 degrees of freedom in this theory, and out of those 11 degrees of freedom, 4 of them are gauge modes. 4 because a first order coordinate transformation in GR has this general form where epsilon is a to first order in perturbation theory, where epsilon here is a vector field with 4 indices. Now, I often find it helpful to think about the analogy with electrodynamics, where there's a field A mu with 4 degrees of freedom. It has this gauge symmetry, where alpha is an arbitrary scalar function. Two field configurations, A mu, that differ by a gradient are understood to be physically equivalent. In this case, there appear to be 4 degrees of freedom in the theory, but then there's a one parameter gauge mode. So with this example, let's think about how we would calculate gauge modes in single field inflation. This is done using the Lie derivative. The tool for this is the Lie derivative. Which I'll talk about for a bit. If you've seen it before, this will be a review. So to motivate the Lie derivative, intuitively is what you get when you transform a tensor under an infinitesimal coordinate transformation. So if I have some tensor, let's say I have a tensor with, to motivate the definition, let's say I have a tensor S with one lower and one upper index. And I specialize this transformation law to the case where x prime is x plus a small perturbation epsilon mu. And I'll just keep track of terms that are first order in epsilon. So plugging this in, so this term would be sorry, the usual sign convention is to put a minus here. I evaluated the Jacobian matrices to first order in epsilon. And then when I shift x prime by epsilon to get x, I can Taylor expand this guy. Multiplying out, keeping only terms that are first order in epsilon, I get an expression like this. And this expression is called the Lie derivative. In general, for a tensor T with m upper indices and n lower indices, then the Lie derivative with respect to a vector, epsilon here is always a vector field, one upper index, is given by a formula that looks similar to the covariant derivative. The first term looks like a partial directional derivative. Then for each upper index, the Lie derivative of the sign is minus for an upper index. There's a term where I can track. For a covariant derivative, I would put a Christoffel symbol here. The way the Lie derivative works is that the factor that appears here is just involves the partial derivatives of epsilon. This would look like the rho would go here, and the mu I would go here. The lower indices I get. Something similar. Here the sigma has to go here, and the nu j goes here. And there's a plus sign for a lower index. Okay, so some properties that I will can be proved from this definition that I'll just list. First off, as suggested by the notation, the Lie derivative is a tensor. That's not obvious from the definition, but you can check that if I write this down in a primed coordinate system, then it's related to the original unprimed coordinate system, provided that the T transforms as a tensor and epsilon transforms as a vector, then the object defined by the right-hand side of this equation will transform as a tensor. It obeys a product rule for tensors with arbitrary numbers of indices. Finally, it commutes with contractions, tensor contractions, in cases where the contraction involves contracting an upper index with a lower index, and there's no hidden factor of the metric. So the linear derivative of an object like this would be the same thing as, you get the same thing if you took the, if you contracted the, the left-hand side is supposed to mean a tensor, a situation where you contract the indices of a tensor first and then take the Lie derivative of the two-index object. You get the same thing if you took the Lie derivative of the four-index object and then contracted the indices. So this expression could be written without the parentheses, and it would be unambiguous. Now you might note the similarity between the Lie derivative and the covariant derivative. Just so I can write them next to each other, I'm going to erase this line stating that it's a tensor. So. For a covariant derivative, the notation nabla sub epsilon, where epsilon is a vector field, means that you take the covariant derivative, adding an index, and then contract with epsilon mu. So I take the usual formula for the covariant derivative. Containing Christoffel symbols, and then add a contraction with a vector field epsilon. Then I get something that looks similar. There's a sign difference. Let's see, so here I get a contraction. The coefficient which appears in the Lie derivative case is just the partial derivative of epsilon. And here it involves no derivatives of epsilon. And it's some expression where you're contracting epsilon against the Christoffel symbol. So they're computed similarly, and they sort of feel similar in calculations, but there are some conceptual differences. One difference is that the Lie derivative doesn't require a metric and really just derives from the transformation law of tensors, whereas the covariant derivative requires extra structure on the space, a choice of metric from which you derive the Christoffel symbols. So in that sense, the Lie derivative is kind of a lower level operation. It doesn't need extra data. Another difference is that the value of the Lie derivative depends on, at a point x, I won't write it down, but I'll just say it in words. The value of the Lie derivative requires, at a point x, requires knowing both the components of epsilon and their first derivatives, whereas the covariant derivative just requires components of epsilon. So if you're thinking about the covariant derivative, it sort of makes sense to think of the covariant derivative as just, at a point, as just being determined by a direction, and you're differentiating in that direction. Whereas the Lie derivative requires more data. It requires the first derivatives of the vector field nearby. On a related note, the covariant derivative of a tensor is always formed by some indices. Contracting epsilon with a covariant derivative that adds an extra index. But there's no analogous statement for the Lie derivative. There's no notion of a Lie derivative which is a tensor with one more index. You always write a vector field down here instead of adding a component. And finally, a computational pitfall to watch out for is that the Lie derivative of the metric is not zero in general. And so the Lie derivative, in particular, that means that the Lie derivative does not commute with raising and lowering indices, or with contractions of indices in which there's a hidden factor of the metric. So for example, if I have a vector field A with a lower index, then I would get different answers if I raise the index and then take the Lie derivative, or take the Lie derivative and then raise the index. So sometimes you have to be careful to parenthesize to make sure you're not introducing, explicitly parenthesize to make sure you're not introducing notational ambiguity. In general, the Lie derivative, the covariant derivative occurs more often, but you want the Lie derivative if you're thinking about coordinate transformations or symmetry properties. For example, if you want to find all the symmetries of a space-time by some sort of algorithmic procedure, we stated earlier, for example, that the general FRW space-time, that the only symmetries are spatial translations and rotations, spatial rotations, that there were no Boost-like or other symmetries. In general, if you want to determine all the symmetries of a space-time, at least at an infinitesimal level, this is the equation you would solve. A vector field epsilon is an infinitesimal symmetry of a space-time, if and only if the Lie derivative of the metric is zero. This is a vector field epsilon of this type is called a killing vector field, some terminology. Okay. Ten minutes, which is perfect for talking about properties of the Lie derivative. There are a few more things I need to tell you about. An interesting thing happens in the case where the Lie derivative you're taking the Lie derivative with respect to one vector field of another vector field, that is a tensor field with one upper index and no lower indices. So if X and Y are vector fields, then if you plug into the definition, the Lie derivative has two terms and can be seen to be anti-symmetric. In X and Y. Of course, that wouldn't be true for a covariant derivative where one thing is being differentiated and the other is not. But for a Lie derivative, both objects which appear are having their components differentiated. And it turns out that there's a symmetry that exchanges them with a minus sign. So this is sometimes written as a definition as the commutator of the two vector fields. This definition of the commutator satisfies the properties that you would expect for a commutator algebra. In addition to the anti-symmetry, it satisfies the Jacobian identity for commutators. I like this cartoon of the commutator as a way of thinking about the Lie derivative. If I have two vector fields, X and Y, and suppose I start at a point, and do the following sequence of integrations. I integrate the vector field x through some distance epsilon. Now I don't need a metric to do that. To integrate a vector field, I'm just solving the differential equation like this, where both indices are upper, and so I don't need a metric to raise and lower any indices to make this be a covariant equation that makes sense. So suppose I integrate the vector field x for some distance epsilon, and then I integrate y for some distance epsilon, then minus x, then minus y. In general, for arbitrary vector fields, this quadrilateral will not close. If you were to Taylor expand these vector fields and take the limit as epsilon goes to zero, there's a residual of order epsilon squared. And the coefficient of the epsilon squared is just the commutator. So you can think about the commutator as plus terms of order epsilon cubed. Measuring the failure of the flows generated by the vector fields to commute. One last property is that the commutator is also the given by this expression involving covariant derivatives. And that's easy to prove if you write out the definitions of these covariant derivatives with Christoffel symbols and write everything out, then you'll get the Lie derivative plus two more terms that cancel by the symmetry of the Christoffel symbol and its lower indices. So these are all the properties of the Lie derivative that we're going to use. Since I have five more minutes, and the next thing is something that I was just going to write down, not really derive, let me say that. Well, maybe I should not cover this up. Right over here. motivation for introducing the Lie derivative was to compute the gauge modes of single field inflation. Yes?
If we weren't working torsion-free, would the two definitions for the commutator still...
Oh, that's right. Yeah, this is only true if the connection is torsion-free.
Okay,
that's right.
Is the...
I suppose it's equivalent to the... This property is equivalent to the connection being torsion-free.
Is the first one like a more fundamental definition for the commutator?
I would say yes, according to my like geometric intuition. Then this definition doesn't depend on the metric. Whereas if you were to change the metric, or if the connection were not derived from the metric and you were to change the connection, then these two objects would change, but their difference would stay fixed. Okay. So the question that we wrote down at the beginning was, what are the gauge modes of single field inflation? And since a gauge mode is just a first-order perturbation that is obtained by applying an infinitesimal coordinate transformation, a first-order coordinate transformation to the zeroth-order background. We said that in words before, but now we have an equation to attach, which is that when I apply a first order coordinate transformation, the fields shift by the Lie derivative, where the Lie derivative is applied to the background. In other words, to enumerate the gauge modes, we just Lie differentiate the background. The most general set of perturbations you can get by Lie differentiating the background are the gauge modes. So for example, when I Lie differentiate the inflaton, in the background, the inflaton is just a function of time. Now, when I Lie differentiate a scalar, there are no indices, so it's just an ordinary directional derivative. So this is epsilon 0 times partial 0 of the background, or epsilon 0 times phi bar dot. And I can do the same with the metric. I can Lie differentiate all components of the FRW metric. And this is a problem in the problem set. So I'll just quote the result. This is what you'll show in the problem set. This is the result of taking the Lie derivative with a general vector field epsilon, Lie differentiating the general FRW vector. These last three equations are not specific to single field inflation, but would apply to any FRW background. So the most general gauge mode in this theory would be a set of perturbations obtained by taking the right-hand side of these equations for some choice of vector field epsilon. OK.